Välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, en podcast från Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health. I den här podden samtalar vi med specialister från olika områden inom hästmedicinen. Med det gemensamt att de delar vår och din passion för hästarna.
Välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, jag heter Maria Willemsson. I det tredje och sista avsnittet med Michael Hewitson tar vi upp frågan om management igen och om utmaningar som kan uppstå. Vi pratar också om bete och huruvida att hålla hästarna mer frilevande verkligen har en skyddande effekt mot magsår. Glöm inte bort att du kan se webbinarierna med Michael Hewitson på vår hemsida vetportal.se. Där är ett webbinar om magsår i den icke-glandulära delen och ett webbinar om magsår i den glandulära delen. Och du som är veterinär kan logga in på vetportal.se och titta på webbinaren där. Let's move on to the management, because we talked a little bit about owner compliance when it comes to the pharmaceutical treatment and the medication. But what's your perception on how good are owners actually in following the advice regarding the management, like the feeding and the routines in the stable?
Well, I think it's challenging because, again, you know, if we consider the type of horse we're talking about, if you think about competition horses, and I did sort of allude to this at the beginning of this podcast, was that, you know, a lot of these horses are essential means of income for these people. And when you think about competition horses, you know, it's not that easy to just suddenly say, well, don't feed them lots of carbohydrate. So you have to tailor the management advice to the specific horse and owner. With respect to race horses, I usually try and suggest to them to feed smaller quantities of starch more often during the day than large meals. And that's based on Nana Luthson's work, where she demonstrated, you know, more than 1 gram per kilogram of starch per feed was a risk factor, and a total of 2 grams per kilo per day was a risk factor. So, you know, you could perhaps try and reduce that excessive fermentation in the stomach and the production of all those volatile fatty acids by feeding smaller feeds more often during the day. With regards to exercise, as I said already, you know, trying to focus on things like, ideally, you know, exercising after they've had a small roughage meal to prevent that splashing effect onto the mucosa. And in an ideal world, perhaps even going so far as doing intense exercise in the afternoon when they've got roughage in their stomachs, and limiting intense exercise to 40 minutes or so, and then the rest days, as we've discussed already. I think those things you have to tailor to the specific training yard or the competition horse that you're talking about. When it comes to things like pasture access and access to roughage, it becomes more challenging when owners have their horses in livery, where somebody else is taking care of some of the management aspects. And I think that's often a place where we fall down, because it's very easy for us to say, okay, well, you know, make sure that this horse has access to ad lib roughage. But then you go to the yard and the yard owner puts some hay into the horse's stable in the morning and in the evening, and they finish it after 2 hours, and then there's nothing, you know? So getting that right can be a real challenge. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier, you know, if you're getting non-responders, it's really worthwhile going and looking in detail at whether or not those management recommendations are actually being implemented or not. The other challenge is we assume that a horse that's turned out is going to be protected. But actually, that's very, very naive of us, because it depends on the quality of the pasture. And it goes both ways. Poor pasture, of course, means those horses are not going to get enough roughage. And in those cases, you should be ideally supplementing them with roughage out in the field, you know, from a hay feeder or whatever, or large bale. On the other hand, you could be turning a horse out into a very rich pasture that's got a lot of sugar in the grass, and those horses then end up with a significant fermentation in their stomach, with production of more volatile fatty acids. So it's very easy for us just to say, yes, turn them out, reduce starch, don't exercise them as much. But actually, we need to tailor those recommendations to the specific horse and the specific yard and what's possible and what's not possible. And I'd like to touch a little bit more on roughage specifically, because one thing we know for sure is that ingestion of good quality roughage is essential for the health of the stomach, and is probably the most important thing you can do to prevent gastric ulcers, specifically, of course, squamous lesions. But I suspect, we don't know, there's no evidence of it, but I suspect for glandular lesions as well in some form or another. And we just assume that when we say a horse must receive ad lib roughage, that they receive it. But as I said already, that's not always the case. And I think you should get owners to measure how much roughage the horse is eating. And they need to measure that the horse is getting at least 2% of body weight and roughage a day. And if they're not, there's a problem, you know?
Because they have access to it doesn't mean they actually eat it.
Absolutely. Always. And it's quite, and on that point as well, you know, I mentioned earlier, you know, recommending to owners to feed some roughage before the horse exercises. Well, some horses won't eat just normal roughage. So you need to provide them a palatable roughage, even if it's a small amount. So, you know, some really palatable alfalfa or something that the horses will eat, and will, you can be guaranteed that they will eat it before they exercise, you know? So you have to really think about these things in more detail than just the sort of general blanket recommendations with this assumption that, that one recipe, meets all horses' needs. 'Cause I don't think that's the case.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. 'Cause, it's, and especially with those that are a little bit underweight, and maybe they're also very stressed individuals. I mean, the more time you spend looking around or crib biting or doing something else, the less time you can spend eating, right?
So absolutely,
that's something you need to be cautious about as well. But then I'm going to have to ask you a tricky one. What with the laminitis-prone ones that... the obese ponies. They're not the typical Aegis patient, maybe, but they do get ulcers as well.
I don't think you can assume that. Unfortunately, there is no typical Aegis patient.
No,
I think what one thing we do know now is that any type of horse can get this disease.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a real challenge. And I alluded to that in my lecture, about when I talked about straw. I don't know if you remember, you know, it's not the quality of the roughage so much as the presence of roughage in the stomach. So, you know, a horse, let's say an obese pony with laminitis and equine, metabolic syndrome, you know, you're going to want to limit the amount of roughage that you give that, that horse, you know, to 1.5% of body weight or something. But some of the things you could potentially do is, include some straw in that, to just decrease the caloric content of the roughage, but still provide the fiber that acts as that all important protective mat in the stomach. So that's certainly one thing you can do with these horses. So I think the take home message is, you know, it's about getting roughage into the stomach. And if there's a limited quantity of roughage that you can give that horse, then consider things like double hay nets and slow feeders and that sort of thing. Because actually the horse doesn't need a lot of roughage in its stomach to have this pH stratification. I mean, you're talking about sort of 300 grams or something. It's not a lot.
Mm.
So it's really important that you don't just throw in, you know, the whole pony's daily requirement and it eats it all in 2 hours, you know.
Mm.
Try and feed slowly through a slow feeder or double hay net or something. And as I say, consider potentially mixing some of that roughage with straw.
Mm. So it's more about making sure that the stomach is not empty, really.
Correct.
If it's not on medication, then.
The one thing you absolutely want to avoid at all costs is an empty stomach.
Yeah.
And you know, we all talk about horses being trickle feeders, but it's essential. You know, I mentioned in my lecture, you know, we can consistently induce ulcers in horses by intermittent fasting. Mm. And it's used as a model for research. So the one thing you absolutely do not want to do is intermittently fast a horse.
Mm.
Which comes back to what I was saying earlier, you know, risk factors and perhaps prophylactic use of omeprazole. If you're transporting a horse, for example, and you know it's not going to have access to roughage and there's going to be intermittent fasting for some other reason, that would be a time where using omeprazole would be so important.
Mm. Speaking of pasture, what's your thoughts of the newly published study by Nanna Lutherson and her team in Icelandic horses? I think it showed that around 70% of the horses had ESGD in the study. What's your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, very interesting, and actually makes a lot of sense, Nanna's study, because one of the things that I've always wondered about is whether a certain degree of gastric ulceration is almost normal in horses. And when I say normal, I mean that it happens, but the horses have got the ability to deal with it if you take away the risk factor,
mm.
meaning that some horses will improve without treatment. Now, I'm not saying that they shouldn't be treated at all. Don't get me wrong. But it's quite interesting when you look at the fact that in feral horse populations, horses that are under extensive management, they do have ulcers. You know, Nanna found up to 70% of these horses have ulcers. It doesn't mean that they shouldn't be treated, but it does suggest that there are risk factors in the normal environment of a horse that are not related to man-made risk factors that can predispose a horse to ulcers. And I think in Nanna's study, it was really interesting. It seemed to be associated with certain groups of horses in certain parts of Iceland. And I suspect it's probably related to factors such as the amount and of roughage that those horses had available to them. And also potentially the stresses, the social stresses that those horses might have been under at that time, you know, perhaps, you know, two stallions vying for control of the herd and what, who knows, or environmental stresses, you know, particularly cold weather or anything like that, that could potentially predispose these horses to ulcers. So, it's an interesting study and it supports the thought that, the risk factors for gastric ulceration horses are multifactorial and they're not necessarily just associated with man-made intensive domestication. And actually, Nanna showed really nicely that actually man-made intervention can reduce the prevalence of these ulcers by, surprise, surprise, providing good quality roughage.
Yeah.
So it's a lovely study because it just demonstrates what we think is going on and what we know is going on in these horses. And
what do you think about the fact that they were Icelandic horses? I mean, we have a lot of those in the Nordics. And one thing that is a common sort of feature in these horses is that they don't really demonstrate pain. Mm. They don't give.
Oh, you're right.
Not that dramatic, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I worked with them when I was in Helsinki, and you know, as you know, I mean, if an Icelandic horse shows colic, you got to know that they're extremely sick.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, we've already had this discussion about clinical signs, and maybe in the Icelandic population, it's exacerbated even further that even with severe ulcers, they don't show clinical signs. And it goes back to what I said to you before, that we should be potentially gastroscoping these horses using other criteria like risk factors, for example.
Mm.
And it might be even so, for example, these Icelandic horses, maybe we need to try and identify periods of time during the year where they're more likely to have ulcers and gastroscope them at that time to identify horses that could benefit from treatment, you know.
Mm.
Because I don't think we can rely on clinical signs. And I think you're right, probably in Icelandic horses, even less so.
Mm. Are there any myths or misconceptions on aegis that you would like to take the opportunity to debunk? Maybe my comment about the typical aegis patient was one of them. But
well, apart from the things I've already touched on, you know, the classical clinical signs of gastric ulceration, I don't think there is such a thing as a classical clinical sign, and my research supports that. But I think I'd like to touch on something, and I don't know if it's commonplace in Nordic countries, but certainly in the UK, there seems to be this obsession amongst owners about hindgut ulcers. I don't know if you've heard this in the Nordic countries.
It's not something that I'm unaware of, but I don't think it's that big of a discussion, really.
I mean, it's something that's come out of, it's all over the internet and all over social media that horses with gastric ulcers also potentially might have hindgut ulcers, and that these hindgut ulcers are responsible for all these other clinical signs that we talk about. And it stems from one very poorly designed study that was done in the States on abattoir horses, where they found a large proportion of these horses had ulcers in their colons.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been perpetuated through various channels on the internet. I won't go into detail specifically how, but it's now a common perception amongst horse owners here in the UK that hindgut ulcers is a big deal. And if you scope a horse and it's got a normal stomach, they say, well, what about hindgut ulcers? Okay. The fact of the matter is there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that horses get hindgut ulcers, meaning ulcers in their colon, apart from horses that are treated with very high doses of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And that's a different disease. It's called an ulcerative colitis. And it has no association at all with gastric ulcers. Mm. So that's a myth that seems to be quite popular here amongst clients in the UK, horse owners in the UK. I don't know if it's the same in Nordic countries.
No, not that I'm aware of, at least. But then maybe this can act as a prevention from it coming here.
Yeah. Yeah.
The misconception.
Yeah.
Do you meet any misconceptions among veterinarians?
No, I think most veterinarians are very familiar and very aware of equine gastric ulcer syndrome. I mean, there's been so much literature on it, and we've learned so much over the past 10 years that I think most veterinarians are very comfortable with the treatment. I think the only thing I would just try and remind veterinarians are the importance of identifying which part of the stomach is affected because of the differences we've talked about.
Mm. To sum it up, I mean, you've touched on lots of important takeaways and things that anyone listening should consider. But if you could just really short have one or two the most important take home message that you want to share with your Nordic veterinary colleagues.
Right. I think, and I have touched on these things already, but I'll summarize them again or conclude. The first thing is make sure that you differentiate between squamous gastric disease and glandular gastric disease when you're gastroscoping these horses. You can't just assume that you treat gastric ulcers the same. I think we know that, and hopefully I've shown you that in my lectures. The second thing is don't just rely on clinical signs to recognize a horse that could benefit from gastric gastroscopy. Think about risk factors as well. And remember that some horses won't show clinical signs. And then think very carefully about the pharmacology of omeprazole when you use it. And I hope that I've explained the reasons why I say that. Think about the absorption. Think about when you're going to give the drug. Think about the importance of starving the horse prior to giving it. And if you have treatment failures, remember that, you know, there's usually a reason why that's occurred. And just because you've prescribed the omeprazole doesn't necessarily mean it's been given appropriately. And that's one of the things you need to check first. Mm-hmm. So thinking very carefully about how you use the drug, and also think about this concept of rebound acid secretion. And particularly if a horse is going to be on it for long term, you might want to consider tapering it. Avoid using omeprazole as a blanket preventative measure, but rather use it as a pulse dose if necessary. And then don't underestimate the importance of management. It's critical. And the management recommendations to prevent squamous gastric disease are not going to do any harm for glandular gastric disease. So implement them anyway. But then in addition to that, if you do have glandular gastric disease, think about behavioral stresses. And that sometimes takes a little bit of detective work to work out what it is. But often that'll give you a good success if you can work it out. Mm.
That sums it up quite nicely, I think. Thank you so much, Mike, for your time and for participating in this podcast. It's been really interesting to talk to you.
Tack för att du lyssnar på Hästveterinärerna. Om du gillar det du hör, glöm inte att trycka prenumerera i din podcast-app så att du inte missar några avsnitt. Berätta också gärna om vad du tycker genom att ge en recension. Vi tar gärna emot tips på kommande gäster och ämnen, och våra kontaktuppgifter finns i poddens beskrivning.